Welcome to Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm your host for today, Sally DeBoer. On today's show, we'll be talking about the recent ruling by the UN Permanent Court of Arbitration on territorial claims in the South China Sea with retired Navy Captain James Fennell. Before we get started, here's a quick word about SIMSEC.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. No matter how you choose to support us, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Join us today.
Welcome to another episode of Sea Control, the podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm your host for today, Sally DeBoer. On July 12th, the UN's Permanent Court of Arbitration ruled on territorial disputes between the PRC and the Philippines in the South China Sea. The court ruled largely on the side of the Philippines, denying the legitimacy of China's claims and upholding international law as outlined by the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, recognizing territorial seas but not exclusive economic zones of several disputed features, including the Spratly Islands. Further, the court found that China violated the Philippine sovereignty when they interfered with fishing and petroleum exploration activities in the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. The court also upheld the right of both China and the Philippines to conduct fishing in and around Scarborough Shoal. China, who has denied and continues to deny the legitimacy of the court's ruling, has publicly stated their intention to both ignore the court's findings and continue construction of artificial islands. Immediate responses from Chinese media stated that the ruling was, quote, an American-backed farce, while statements from Chinese officials seem to echo this sentiment and reinforce their commitment to exercising control over their nine dash line claims. There's clearly a great deal to discuss here, and we're lucky to have an expert on the matter here today. Joining us is retired Navy Captain James Fennell, former Director of Intelligence and Information Operations for the U.S. Navy's Pacific Fleet and founder of Red Star Rising. In the tradition of Sea Control, we'll go ahead and give Captain Fennell a chance to introduce himself before we get started.
Well, good afternoon, Sally, and again, thanks for inviting me to participate in Sea Control and SIMSEC's valuable efforts to bring information to the general public and raise our consciousness on what's going on in the maritime domain. I'm pleased to talk about this subject. I think there's a lot to cover, and I'll just say that I'm happy to be talking to you from Eastern Switzerland, where I'm currently a fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy.
Great. Well, glad to have you, sir, and let's get started. I wanted to begin by sort of characterizing the ruling in a larger sense and kind of get your general impression of the court's finding. Was it more or less sweeping than you'd expected? And are there any facets of the ruling that surprised you?
Yeah, I think the ruling itself is a resounding repudiation of China's actions and statements and posture over the last 5 years in the Asia-Pacific region. The court went much farther than I think anybody had predicted in any of the academic communities or intelligence communities that I'm associated with. I think the court surprised many people by pointing out the things that you described in your opening, which is to say that they ruled on the validity of whether or not something was entitled to an exclusive economic zone or a territorial sea. And they raised the bar specifically on what constitutes an island with respect to Ituaba. Previously, I think many in the communities had thought that the requirements based on a general reading of UNCLOS would suggest that if you could provide habitability from a land feature to include its own water sources, that somehow would guarantee you an exclusive economic zone. And the court raised that bar and said, no, it has to be more than just water that can be life-sustaining. It has to show a demonstration of habitability and living. And in that sense, the court looked back at history and said, no, there's really nothing in Ituaba that would even suggest that. Now, that's caused a little bit of a interesting development between Taiwan and China. But besides that one point, I think the larger issue is that there was really nothing here for China, the People's Republic of China. They had nothing to hang their hat on. There's nothing for them to go forward with. So from that standpoint, it's going to be very difficult for them in terms of saving face. But from an international law perspective, and what I think most of the world accepts, is that China's actions down there in the South China Sea were both unilateral, were aggressive, and threatening to their neighbors. And this ruling, as it states, is saying that that's not correct, and that's not a accepted way to act in the international community.
So definitely a precedent-setting ruling then. I wanted to talk next about, you sort of talked on China's ability to save face, and I want to talk for a little while about China's response to the issue. It's an understatement to say they haven't taken it well. Before we talk about sort of the international response, I kind of wanted to talk about the internal reaction and the domestic response, which has been negative and largely anti-U.S. I wanted specifically to touch on that in 2017, the PRC's 19th Party Congress is going to occur, and there's a significant potential for change. And how much of do you think this response is Xi Jinping's attempt to maintain credibility and consistency with his domestic audience?
I think, based on the research that you see from the Red Star Rising and the scouring of the Chinese open language or unclassified press reporting in English and in Chinese, what we're seeing is a unified response across both their domestic audience and their world audience that says they refuse to accept this. And as I think you mentioned, they're using the term farce. Just about every Chinese article that responds to this since the ruling came out on a daily basis has used the word farce. The main Chinese press organs all have special web pages devoted to this South China Sea arbitration. The farce should end. So there's no question that the party has adopted a pretty strict line on responding to this. And it's not just the party press organs. It's been the senior leaders of China, from President Xi, their foreign minister, Admiral Wu, the head of their navy, across just anybody that's commented on this has all said they're not going to accept this, and China will not accept this ruling. What's more worrisome is they've said that they're going to, if challenged, will respond in kind. And so I think that's the great concern for everyone, is just how far will China go to disregard this ruling, and will they use physical force, physical violence to maintain their physical possession over these disputed areas now? They say they won't do that. They say that they are always peace-loving and that they're not going to inhibit anybody's freedom of navigation. But in the same sentences or the same speeches, they tell us that they're going to not accept outside influence from non-parties of the region, and that they're not going to accept having their sovereignty violated. So that's the concern that people have right now.
And in your opinion, it sounds to me, with the consistency of language and all the press sources, is this just response part? It serves a larger Chinese narrative that here we are, this peaceful region, and the United States is interjecting itself in affairs where it doesn't belong.
Yeah, that's exactly what they've said. They've characterized the United States as being the offending party. In fact, today there was an article in one of the press organs that said just the presence of the United States is offensive and causes problems. Not just that we do freedom of navigation operations, but just our very presence has been a destabilizing factor. So the narrative over the last 5 years from China has changed to one where they said we're willing to, we're not trying to displace the United States, which they still say in some circles. But now you're starting to hear this, hey, the United States' very presence is causing the turmoil, and they need to get out, and it's not us that's the problem, which is in complete contradiction of what this, impartial, unbiased tribunal out of The Hague handed down 2 weeks ago. And, as you can imagine, the Chinese press has gone after The Hague's ruling, first to discredit them as saying they're not part of the United Nations, and then now going after one of the senior members of the tribunal and saying that he was biased, Japanese national, and therefore was not capable of, was only implementing the desires of Prime Minister Abe. So their attack on this ruling is across the board, across all facets of conversation and ideological perspectives. They are 100% going after this thing. And I think it's an indicator of what they're actually going to do in the physical domain over the course of the next year in the lead up to the party Congress that you mentioned.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to see the domestic response. And one of our SimSec members posted this video, and I'll try and find a link for our listeners and post it on the post for this podcast. But it was this really clunky metaphor that they used that, oh, imagine you have this beautiful apartment and this parking lot across town that you own a parking spot in, and then sort of went on and on with this narrative. But the assumption that you own this parking spot is the only thing anyone disagrees on. So it was a really, I'll have to post it. It was an interesting thing to watch. So going on, we talked a little bit earlier about the Chief of Naval Operations visit to China and his discussion with the People's Liberation Army Navy's Admiral Wu Xingli. It sounds as though from Admiral Richardson's statement, he was roundly assured that construction in the Spratly Islands was never going to stop. And what do you make of this directness, and what can the United States do to reinforce the court's rulings?
Yeah, Admiral Richardson's visit, there's been some level of controversy inside the United States regarding the timing of this visit. He's accompanying National Security Advisor Rice to China, accompanied her. And the issue was, you know, what kind of message was he taking and what kind of message did he receive? And as you mentioned, the message that he received was very clear and unambiguous from Admiral Wu Xingli, which is to say, we reject the findings of this court. It has no legitimacy. It has no authority. And these are our sovereign territory. It's been that way since ancient times. And it will be on our place in choosing when to declare a South China Sea Air Defense Identification Zone. It will be in our time in choosing when to place military equipment on these islands, and we will do that in response to the challenges that we get from the Philippines or Japan or the you know, United States. So Admiral Richardson, you know, in many respects, some have commented, and to include myself, was, you know, given a lecture by Admiral Wu Xingli. And so we can talk about that at another time. But the simplistic answer is that it appears that the Chinese were able to take this visit that surely was prearranged before the knowing of when the scheduled court ruling was going to come out and use that to their advantage and make it seem to the people of China that the United States was coming and kowtowing to the leaders of Beijing to say, hey, we're in charge. Yeah, you have some piece of paper, but paper doesn't mean anything. Possession's 9/10 of the law, and we own it all, and we're physically controlling it. What will be interesting to see is what will come out of the dialogue between Admiral Richardson and Admiral Wu regarding the specific issue of the Scarborough Reef. And I think there's some concern there. I think Admiral Richardson had, you know, made some statements back in April about his great concern that China was preparing to build up Scarborough Reef just like it had done down at the seven New Spratly Islands down in the southern South China Sea. So the question of whether or not China will use this ruling as a justification for going ahead and reclaiming land around Scarborough and building another base there, if you will, another naval installation. I'm not sure they'll build a naval air station per se, since Hainan Island is fairly close. But if they do, it will give them control now of the northern approaches to the South China Sea, just like they have now physical kind of control and possession of the southern approaches to the South China Sea. So this is the concern, and I'm, you know, I'm really, I don't want to say I'd speak for Admiral Richardson. I don't. But I feel, you know, somewhat disappointed and ashamed that he had to take that kind of verbal abuse in the public domain when we knew kind of that the Chinese were going to reject this ruling in the first place.
Certainly. So they're sending a very unambiguous message in terms of their statements and their discussion with Admiral Richardson. But they're also sending a physical message as well. With earlier this week, there was the H-6K overflight of Scarborough Shoal. What do you make of that? And what do you make of the exercises around Hainan Island, which I think were planned, or I'm sure were planned, well before this ruling, but they're quote-unquote closing off a part of the South China Sea, which isn't tremendously in line with any legal precedent.
Yeah, I think the H-6K bomber activity and that flight, and even some of their experts, PLA Navy experts that were commenting in the press, said, you know, this is the first time that we've publicly provided these pictures, and somewhat implying that it was the first time an H-6K had flown directly over Scarborough Reef. And then they made the point of the fact that it was actually vectored and pointing towards Manila, and it could be used to, you know, do more damage than maybe some would consider. And so, and in that same vein, they talked about now our planes can reach everywhere in the South China Sea, and we can control this ATIS, which is kind of an allusion to the fact that they declared an ATIS in the East China Sea and haven't been able to really effectively control that, given the amount of commercial air jets that go in there and the international community's ire that would occur if they tried to implement something that restrictive. It may be different in the South China Sea, and they may be just as we've talked before about this salami slicing, they may just be slicing the salami slices very thin to get to this point where they implement the ATIS, which, you know, flights over Scarborough, we should expect more of those, including down to the three new naval air stations at Mischa, Fiery Cross, and Subi Reef. Regarding the South China Sea exercise closure areas, I don't know if those were timed ahead of time. One can imagine that they were planned ahead of time, knowing that the ruling was going to come out sometime this summer, and that the PLA Navy and its forces had been prepared to conduct an exercise and were waiting for the timing of the exercise. I don't know that for a fact, but with just going with your assumption that it was already planned, the fact of the matter is they used the already planned exercise to heighten and emphasize their displeasure at this ruling. And I think that's the real key, which is to say it's not just physical, it's not just words and rhetoric, it's actual physical movement of naval forces and other forces into the region, around the region, in a show of force back to the United States and the rest of the world to say, yeah, not only are we telling you we don't agree with this ruling, but we will physically not agree with this ruling. And I think that's the real question about how do we, and you asked that question, what do we do then if they're going to be there in presence? And I would submit that we need to sustain our commitment to the presence that we've demonstrated this year. The dual carrier operations, the continued freedom of navigation operations, the continued presence that we've displayed over seven decades needs to sustain itself. And we need not fear that there will be, conflict start because we're down in the same water space. I don't believe the Chinese at this time are ready to start a shooting war. They're pretty upset. They may get very close, but they recognize they have too much to gamble, too much to lose, both internally and externally, for their dream of restoration and rejuvenation. And I think you saw that even just this day, today, with some of the press reporting out of China, where the Chinese press is now clamping down on the internal protesters and telling internal protesters, hey, you need to, you know, patriotism is good. We understand why you're upset because this ruling is, abhorrent to us. But, you know, you don't have to demonstrate your patriotism by, you know, protesting in front of a Kentucky Fried Chicken outlet.
I did see that. That was an interesting choice. Well, sort of going on that same theme, you're talking about how the United States can sort of counter this escalation or perceived escalation. You mentioned continuing the presence with the dual carrier ops. Are there any continued freedom of navigation exercises? Is that something you'd like to see there as well?
Yeah, I think we need to do that. I think there's, it's been a lot written in the last week or so, and Bonnie Glazer's written some things about it, which I actually agree with her position that says we should do them and do them with advance warning. We should just do our freedom of navigation operations.
Right.
I disagree with her when she said we shouldn't tell people what we've done. I think there is a process to report these out post facto, post event, to say, here's the things that we've done this year and why we did them and the legal reasons that we did them for. I think that's important. But to advertise them ahead of time to you know, put our sailors in harm's way, I think is not very smart. So I do think we should do them. I think we should not just do freedom of navigation operations, which typically are a single ship or an aircraft, but we really need to think about doing more naval exercises in the region with ourselves unilaterally, but also bilaterally and also multilaterally. I think the more that we demonstrate that these are waters that anybody can work in and that China's going to have a tough time covering down in the South China Sea and exercises in the East China Sea, for instance, Annual X with the Japanese Navy, the JMSDF, we should be doing Annual X's west of Okinawa. To put this kind of perspective into the Chinese, which is to say, hey, if you really want to prevent people from exercising their militaries all over the first island chain, then you're going to be stretched very thin. And, you know, some would say, well, maybe the Chinese can match us ship for ship. Maybe they can against the U.S. 7th Fleet today, but they cannot against the allied forces, naval forces of the region. And I think that's the real strong position that we take that. We will demonstrate to China that they need to change their behaviors.
Yeah, and going back to your point about the freedom of navigation exercises and pre-announcing them, I think the point has been made several times, and I think probably by you when you've been on our podcast before, that the announcement itself implies some sort of wrongdoing. If we truly believe that it's freedom of navigation, it's international waters, then there should be no need to announce. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it's just a daily business. You're just going about daily operations, and if you happen to sail through some place that is disputed, then you do that or you don't do that. But you don't have to make a big deal out of it.
Yeah, the message is very clear. It's just as though anywhere else.
And I would say, though, there's a nuance here. You don't have to make a big deal out of it, not because you're concerned so much that China is going to get upset. Now, granted, I don't think we should go out of our way just to antagonize China, but I don't think we should also limit our actions because we're always concerned about antagonizing, which seems to be what we normally do. I think we don't advertise it for the security and safety of the sailors from our side that are now going to be put in a position of where someone knows they're coming and may set up an ambush or send up a position, set of circumstances that could, you know, cause somebody to lose their life. That's really why I don't think we should do that.
Yeah, it's not hard to imagine a scenario where, you know, maybe implied or intentional or not, something could happen. Accidents happen at sea, especially when ships are getting close. So that could be really an escalatory thing. So your point is very well taken.
And I think that in the position here is it's nuanced because there's many inside the, you know, quote unquote China watching community that are suggesting we don't want to embarrass or upset or provoke China. That seems to be our constant, you know, before we do anything in our own national security interest, we seem to be more concerned about not upsetting them because there's this belief that if we upset them, then our national security will be worse off. I don't think the evidence supports that logic over the last decade, but that still seems to be the predominant mindset, which is provoking China makes things worse. And instead of saying, no, China is the one that's provoking people, changing the status quo, not following, you know, their own declared and signed declarations like the Code of Conduct from 2002 or even their signature on UNCLOS. You know, the Court of Arbitration was very clear. You signed into this, China. You agreed to follow these rules, and now you don't want to. So I think that's the issue. And not so much that the United States has somehow parachuted into the South China Sea in the last 2 years and caused everybody to get upset. Now, we've been there for a long, long time, and we've given everybody a great opportunity to raise their standards of living across Asia, including the Chinese. So, we need to reject this notion that we're the problem, and we need to start identifying that China is the problem. And if we can't do that, they're going to continue to take advantage of us.
Understood. I wanted to talk a little bit about, there's a report this week that China had approached the Philippines for bilateral talks with the condition that both parties agreed to disregard the UN's court ruling. The Chinese did not even want to broach the subject. They didn't want it brought up. And the Philippines declined the talks based on these conditions. Is this an attempt by China to save face? And does this indicate to you that there is a way a politically acceptable way for China and the Philippines to come to an agreement on this outside of this, or no?
Well, I think it was informative to see the Philippine response under the new administration, the Duterte administration. There was some concern in certain circles in China and outside that said, how will he approach China? Will he try to negotiate with them? And now in this first overture by the PRC, it's been very clear that they're not going to at least accept this kind of, set aside the PCA's ruling and, say that it's not valid, and then we'll deal with you. That's a very classic Chinese approach. I live up here in the Alps now, and I see a lot of these granite rocks. And sometimes the rocks crumble off the face and crash down in an avalanche. They do that because every winter the snow comes and water comes in and it finds the smallest crevice. And then it freezes and expands, and it does that over time, and then finally the rock cracks and gives way. And the Chinese approach to diplomacy is like this. They come, the rain comes down, it finds the smallest little crack, the smallest little diplomatic nuanced change in language to try to break somebody off from their core interest. And then if you buy into that, if you accept that, you're going to be separated from what's your strategic national objective. In this case, they suggested to the Philippines, hey, we'll work with you. We can work this out. You just have to say this arbitration ruling was the Court of Arbitration's ruling is invalid and you're not going to accept it. Well, maybe the Philippines will, maybe they won't, but right now they've said no. And I think it should be informative to people to watch how the Chinese approach these things. There'll be that's the soft sell. There's the hard sell, which is H-6K bomber flights. There's the declaration of South China Sea exercise areas. There's the speeches that Admiral Wu Shengli gives to Admiral Richardson. And then there will be this behind closed doors. Hey, I'll work this out with you. Just come along with us.
But I think how much of the Philippines' calculus on rejecting these talks do you think has to do with the fact that they tried that angle with China over Scarborough Shoal in 2012 and were betrayed? Chinese did not uphold their side of the deal.
I think that's an excellent point. Now, some would say, well, how much does the new administration know about what happened in 2012? I think most people in the Philippines generally do know that they were kind of hoodwinked by the Chinese in that quote-unquote agreement. So, their fingers are still, numb from being burned. And so they're less likely to buy into something like this. But, China is very persuasive in their soft power attempts. And so things like, business opportunities and opportunities for Filipinos in China and vice versa, these will all be brought up in closed door sessions behind the public media, and there'll be extreme pressure exerted on this administration to negate or dismiss this ruling and then quote unquote go from there. But you could go back to 2002 and say the same thing, right? China told everybody, hey, we agree with you in principle that no one should change the status quo in the South China Sea. And then they did over the next 14 years.
Slowly. Yeah.
I mean, China's got a track record of saying one thing and doing something else. And I think the more people are exposed to this through bad experiences, the less inclined they are to get stung again.
So if that soft power or that soft sell, as you said, is rejected, how do you see the Chinese responding to that? How will they amend their strategy if this has been sort of this two-pronged approach of having both, as you said, the bomber overflights, this hard sell and the soft sell? If nobody's buying anymore, what's next for China?
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, possession's 9/10 of the law. So they're betting on that no one's going to launch a major naval, invasion of these islands down there to kick them out because the Permanent Court of Arbitration said they weren't theirs. I don't think anybody on the planet is planning to do that or would want to do that. I think China knows that. So the reality is, what do we do from here? Where do we go from here? And is there a way to stop China's expansionism? Well, Scarborough Reef will be that test, right? Because they pretty much have built up most of the islands that they want in the South China Sea, in the Spratlys. Second Thomas Shoal is another one. Okay, there's that grounded LST Sierra Madre that they could try to physically take. So the Philippines and And her allies need to watch for that, clearly. I mean, China's already, you know, been vociferous over the last 5-6 years. Since 1999, they've been very upset about it. Now, with the ruling out, they may use this as one of those areas to just come and seize in the middle of the night, come in with a bunch of warships that are just literally with miles away and under the cover of darkness and a rather, you know, poor indications of warning network that maybe the Philippine Navy has down there and the Coast Guard. They could rush in and do something. So we need to watch Second Thomas Shoal. We need to watch Reed Bank or Recto Bank. There's things there that China could just move in and start dredging and try to build something at Reed Bank. Scarborough clearly is a place that I think's got a lot of attention and where the Chinese already have the toehold in there. They've got possession of it. So it would be rather easy for them to try to do something. And so the United States and the Philippines and the other allies in the region have to ask themselves, what are we going to do to physically prevent China to do that? You know, taking back Mischief Reef or Subi Reef or Fiery Cross or Cordouan or Gavin Reef, that's going to be hard. And nobody really wants to do that. And those may be gone forever, maybe. But these other areas I just mentioned, Recto, Second Thomas, Scarborough, those are areas where we can go there on a routine basis and have continuous presence, which is going to require, you know, more than maybe the 60-40 split that we talked about in the pivot. It's going to require more assets to be patrolling around. It may require our Coast Guard. It may require other nations' Coast Guards to be there to physically prevent China from building these things up. That would be the strongest signal that we could send. And it would require not just ships and submarines, not just ships, but maybe submarines supporting aircraft, definitely, the reconnaissance flights with fighter escorts to be able to get across to China. Hey, you really crossed this line without publicizing red lines and without getting into that geopolitical mess by just physically doing that. And I think a lot of people are considering that. I think what we've seen with the Stennis strike group's operations are a nod to that, but now it's got to be more than just these high-profile exercises and dual carrier ops. It's got to be this commitment to a daily presence. Otherwise, China knows they are there daily. They have increased their presence in the South China Sea by, you know, my own estimates, at least tenfold. And so they have a lot of platforms from their Coast Guard and their Navy that are in and around those waters 24/7, 365. And if we really want to stop them from expanding, what they've done into these new areas, we're going to have to be there and match them, kind of hole for hole in some sense.
Understood. I want to wrap up with this question. The disparity between sort of the Chinese response to this ruling and the American public's response to this ruling could not be more disparate. Having a presence there will cost money. It will take more investment and over time, maybe a larger Navy. How can we as naval watchers or China watchers communicate to the larger American public the importance of this issue?
Well, you're exactly right. It will definitely require a larger Navy. And so I think that's a topic of discussion, at least in one of the parties coming up in this election cycle for president. It's, you know, what's the size of our Navy and is it big enough to do the kinds of things that we need it to do? There's arguments on both sides that say there's not enough money to procure this. And even if you had the money, it would take years to get it. And so that's a difficult issue. But we need to address it in dialogue with the American people about the necessity for having it. I think, as I mentioned before, you know, it's the responsibility of senior Navy and naval leaders to articulate this message to our senior policymakers and to make it something that gets articulated in the discussion with the American people. When I talked to one naval officer a few weeks ago or a week ago after the court ruling came out, you know, the response I got was, hey, these are just a bunch of rocks and they have no bearing on U.S. national security. That really troubles me. In the 1980s, when Secretary of Navy Lehman created a maritime strategy with the senior leaders of the uniform leaders of our Navy, there was no question about our national objective of making sure that, you know, the spread of communism didn't go worldwide and that the United States Navy was a key part of, you know, that national objective. We need to be able to have naval leaders that explain to the American public and its policymakers from either party that the reason you need this big navy is because if China can control the South China Sea and can control who can come in and out, even though they've denied that they will do that, despite we have knowledge that says they may have plans to do that, that will adversely affect our national interest and the interest of all the countries in the region and in this global economy. And so we need to have leaders that are going to be more forceful in articulating this requirement. Now, the pivot, the rebalance of the Pacific is one step. The 60-40 that we announced for our Navy, the split to the Pacific, that's good. Some of the new capabilities that we're bringing out, like P-8 and Virginia-class submarines and, the Arleigh Burke destroyer, these things that are coming out, those are all good uses of our bully pulpit with the resources that we have. But I am concerned when I see things like our State Department given an anemic response the day after the permanent court's ruling came out, and we basically equivocated and said, hey, China and Philippines, you're co-equals in this ruling, and you both need to pay attention to it. And we had a chance in a very small window to come out and say we endorse international law, we endorse this ruling, and that we are going to back it up with not only our physical force of the United States military, but those of our allies, and to build on a cooperation of nations to suppress China's unilateral and aggressive behavior. And we missed that opportunity. I'm still waiting for the State Department. Their spokesman said that they would come out with a detailed analysis of the ruling. Well, it's now been well over a week and a half, almost 2 weeks, and we still don't have it yet. Very smart people like Mr. Jerome Cohen have already come out with a detailed analysis of the court's 500 plus page ruling and gave it an endorsement. And so I think this is the kind of comprehensive national power that China applies to a problem that we seem to be lacking. And I think we need to come together on this. Otherwise, yeah, we risk our ability to say that freedom of navigation is around the world.
Yeah, I think there's sort of a fundamental misunderstanding coming back to talking about the just a bunch of rocks quote. And you mentioned this previously, the U.S. Navy has been the arbiter of the freedom of the global commons for a long time now. It has fostered a system that has allowed people to raise their standard of living and a collective successful global system that is unprecedented in history, and yet nobody quite seems to appreciate the U.S. Navy's role in that. That's sort of my very pro-Navy take, but...
Well, and if you believe that, not everybody does, but let's just put it this way. If the people within the maritime world of the United States, the U.S. Navy and maritime people, can't get unified on that belief, then we're going to fail in articulating that to the American public, especially at times when we're at crises in other areas of maritime endeavors. Let's talk about Russia and what's going on in the Mediterranean and with, issues with Syria. Or let's talk about Iran and the threats that they're making to naval forces in the Persian Gulf. I mean, these are not just isolated to the East Asia arena. This is a global issue, and we've been a global navy. Some people say we can't be the world's cop. Okay, got it. Maybe for different, events in different land areas. But we have said, and we have been committed to being the world's cop in the maritime domain. And if we're not going to do that, then let's have a big discussion about that as a nation, and let's save billions of dollars and cut back and pull the Seventh Fleet back to Hawaii or San Diego and quit building, Ford-class nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and quit that. We don't need an SSNBX. I mean, there's a lot of things that are implied in this idea of standing down from being a global navy. And we are being challenged right now in East Asia. And it's not just in the South China Sea. It's in the East China Sea as well. And Japan will be one of the next points of attack for the Chinese based on how they do in this South China Sea scenario.
Well, I think we could probably talk about this much longer, but we've reached our time for today. It was a tremendous honor speaking with you today, and I want to thank you on behalf of SimSec and all our listeners on Sea Control for joining us. and bringing your expertise to the discussion of this issue. I have no doubt that there'll be more to come, and I hope you'll join us again for further analysis. Before we wrap up, I wanted to encourage any listeners who want to know more about this issue and other related issues to subscribe to Red Star Rising. How can our listeners do this, sir?
Yeah, if they just want to send me an email at kimo.fannell, F-A-N-E-L-L, at gmail.com.
Okay, great. And I encourage everyone to do that. Thanks for your time, sir.
Great, Sally. Thanks, and appreciate all that you're doing to get the word out.
And thanks for listening to Sea Control.